Thank you very much. Well, you know, for many of us, working in this field has been extremely frustrating over the years. And so I think this is an exciting time for us, because I think finally we can see some light at the end of the tunnel, that I think we're emerging from this period of frustration, I think, into a new era. And, you know, my view of condensed matter physics, I think a lot of physics, is that it's built on kind of a three-legged stool, right? There's theory, and analytic theory, and of course there's experiment. And then numerics are playing a more and more dominant role. And when things work, you know, you have flow and feedback back and forth between all these three things, and that's really when you make great progress and things are exciting. So an example is fractional quantum Hall effect. We started with experiment and then theory, and then numerics happens to be very successful in that field. And mesoscopic, in the 80s and 90s, you know, every theory paper that you write somehow works, but that was very unusual. So some of us were spoiled that way. And recently, topological insulator is led by theory, but now, you know, there are lots of experiments and so on. Well, I think thin liquid is a little bit unfortunate in the sense that I think the development was theory centered for many years, and then I think somehow these arrows were missing. Has been missing for a long time, and so for those of us who is working on this, it's a very frustrating experience. And I think things got so bad that I remember in about 2003 or 2004, I was in Aspen and I gave a talk on this, and it's working. My good friend Elihu Abrahams took me aside afterwards and said that, you know, you guys are working in this field, there's no experiment. What are you doing? You know, this is beginning to look like string theory. And you know, for a condensed matter theorist, that's of course the ultimate insult. So after that, you know, I couldn't walk around with my, you know, head up, and I was, you know, kind of trying to hide. And so fortunately, in 2005, I think our fortune started to change, because I think there was the first experiment that came in from one of our organizers, Kazuyoshi Kanoda, who discovered something very interesting, observation in a class of organic materials that he was studying. And so I think that was really the turning point. So slowly, I think we are beginning to build these bridges. Since that time, there are more experiments that I'll tell you a little bit about. And the other very interesting thing is that in the last few years, there has been great advances in numerical work, which frankly took me completely by surprise, because I, you know, the tools that people have available for these very difficult complex problem, for example, exact ionization, but the trouble is that, of course, your problem goes exponentially, scale exponentially with the system size, so typically people can only do 30 or 40 sites, and then you're dead, right? Sometimes you can do quantum Monte Carlo, but you know, most often you run into this fermion sign problem, and then again you're dead in the water. And somehow there's a myth that any problems that are interesting always have a sign problem. That may or may not be true. And I think we're maybe seeing some counterexample of that recently. But other than that, we're kind of basically stuck, because it's very hard to make any controlled, even numerical work that is believable. But I think things again have changed. I think starting with this work of the MRG, stands for Density Matrix Renormalization Group, which was invented by Steve White, one of our organizers, a number of years ago. But he's really pushed this technique further and further. It's very successful in 1D, we know that for many years. But now I think he's demonstrated that, collectively, we have demonstrated that, people have demonstrated that it really works for a quasi-1D situation, and it would be able to inform us about a two-dimensional situation. So that's kind of the laid out plan, and I think this is why we think this workshop is very exciting, because I think our goal is to bring together all these people and hope to build these bridges, then we can have fun. So let me then go in and tell you a little bit more about this. I thought I'll start by telling you the history, give you a historical perspective, and I'll start by explaining to you 80 years of the history of 80 years of magnetism. Okay. First, magnetism is known for 3,000 years or more, but the understanding of it really relies on quantum mechanics and strong correlation. So from these, of course, we have to wait until the 20th century. Why do we need quantum mechanics? That was understood by Heisenberg. So the first, correct explanation of magnetism is really due to Heisenberg exchange. So he understood that, and the notion of strong correlation really comes from Mach, who pointed out that electrons or spin can be localized, be held in place, and form local moments. And then these local moments coupled each other via this exchange to give us magnetism, as we know it. So just a quick word about Mach. So Mach has this idea that suppose we take a bunch of hydrogen atoms and just somehow nail them in place. When they're very far apart, of course, like in space, we know that electrons are totally bound to the nucleus, and then this is an insulator. But if you can somehow squeeze them together and they form a lattice, then quantum mechanics, firstly physics tells you that the electrons will form a band, some kind of a band. And because we have one electron per unit cell, the band can be, we have up and down spin electrons, so the bands are half filled, what we call half filled. So therefore, the chemical potential is always in the middle of the band. So therefore, this is always a gapless situation. And it costs nothing to excite some carriers, and so the carriers would be delocalized. So now, if I squeeze these together, these electrons are going to run around freely, and that's the mantle. So in a one electron picture, if you just solve the problem of electrons seeing this periodic potential of the nucleus, you're guaranteed that this has to be a metal. And so Mach, of course, being someone who has a great deal of common sense, said that this is ridiculous, right? Because we know that if you take this thing, if you really crush it together, it will be metal, but if you pull them apart, then it has to be insulated, right? So how does it happen? According to band theory, if you pull these atoms apart, all that happens is that this bandwidth gets narrow and narrow. But morally, it's still a metal. So you cannot avoid it. So the only way you can avoid it is by putting back the interaction of these electrons with each other. And remember that it's very costly to put two electrons on the same hydrogen atom. It's still bound, barely bound, so it basically costs you 13 volts to put two electrons on the atom. And so for these electrons to be mobile running around, you necessarily have to put two of them on the side at some point, and that simply becomes too costly. And when that happens, the electrons just say that, well, forget about this business of running around. I'll just stay home. So the electrons just stay home and form these localized states. So that would form an insulator, and we call that the Mach insulator. Okay. Because that's an insulator that is caused by strong repulsion, or we call strong correlation physics, okay, and cannot be understood in terms of density. Okay, now, so now once these electrons are localized, there's still a degree of freedom left because the electron carries spin, so the electron can either be spin up or spin down. Okay. And you may think that it will form a massively degenerate state. But a corollary of this thing is the Heisenberg exchange. And Heisenberg comes and say that once you get to this situation, the spins will prefer to be anti-ferromagnetic aligned. It's just like what I will be up and down. Why? Because if the spins were anti-ferromagnetic aligned, then I can still virtually hop. This guy can virtually go here and come back. Hop here at pace is 13 volts energy. Very costly, but still, he can do that. But if the spins are parallel, Pauli tells you that you absolutely cannot go there, right? No matter how much you get willing to pay. Okay? So this is totally suppressed, the virtual process, but this is allowed. Now, second order perturbation theory is always negative, attractive, so this always gains you some energy, and therefore this is allowed. So Heisenberg, he can summarize this by what we call Heisenberg exchange. So the low energy Hamiltonian is just described by the spin degrees of freedom, everything else is frozen out, and the spin degrees of freedom is a spin and a half, let's say these are spin and a half operators. So that makes it a quantum spin problem instead of a particle spin, because it's a quantum Hamiltonian. There's an exchange interaction, and this exchange interaction turns out to be given by 4t squared over u. T is the hopping amplitude, depending on how, you know, the overlap of the wave function, and u is this repulsive energy, which is 13 volts for the hydrogen atom. Okay. So for a hydrogen atom, this may be extremely small, but in reality, we can get into a situation where these are comparable. And then as a function of u over t, then there's a phase transition. I guess this is u over t. From between the metal and the because this argument works when u is much bigger than t, you guys are frozen. But if u is less than t, that's like copper. So we call this a Mach transition. And this argument of Heisenberg really works in what you call the large U limit towards here. So this is where you have this Heisenberg exchange. So most of the insulator that we know, and many of these transition metal oxides, belong to this class or related thereof. Okay. So so really it takes quantum mechanics and strong correlation to understand the origin of these local moments and the exchange interaction between them. And once you understand that, of course, the next step was taken by Nail. About 1934. And so what he did is take basically the Heisenberg model and he did mean field theory. Which today we will assign as a homework problem to our student. But you know, very novel in 1934. And he predicted that there's an anti-ferromagnetic ground state. Obviously, if you have a string of these spins, if it favors up down, the obvious idea is that you will form at all the moment. So these guys are now on average frozen. There's a broken symmetry. They'll be pointing. They'll choose some direction to point. So that's one of the earliest examples of broken symmetry, and so on. Okay. As we know, Nail won the Nobel Prize for this theory. And today, the notion of anti-ferromagnet state book and symmetry say is so ingrained in us that it, we just take it for granted. It's so obvious. It must be true. Right? And we know many examples of anti-Islamic language. But it turns out that this idea was not accepted for a number of years. He was being attacked by various people. And, none other than famous people like Landau were going around attacking Nael, saying that this cannot be right. What bothered him? Yeah. So it turns out that, so what bothered him? So, in modern day language, well, even in those days, I think the what bothered him was the following. So he, you see, so depending on the sign of this, the ground state is the ferromagnet. If this is negative, then this will be a ferromagnet. I guess everybody. Now the ferromagnet, this state, which is a wise state, I guess, this thing, everybody got, this is an exact ground state. Because if you apply this to the Hamiltonian, it's an eigenstate. But if this is positive, and you write down this state, this is not an eigenstate at all. And the trouble is, because I can write this as JZ, NZ, NZ, and the X and Y term I can write as spin flip. Right? I can write it as spin flip term. Okay. So this is why the quantum nature of this thing comes in. And classically, of course, this is an obvious. If this were a classical spin, this would be obviously a good state. But quantum mechanically, I have to find an eigenstate. And the Hamiltonian has a spin flip term. So what the spin flip term would do to the Nael state is that if I apply this, if I apply the Hamiltonian to the state, it's going to mutually flip these guys. Right? And this will start breaking this order, right? And you know, if I can do it once, what's to stop me to do it again, right? If I do it again and again, then even if I start with this Nael state, if I apply the Hamiltonian to it enough times, I would mess up the whole thing, okay? So this is really quantum fluctuation. Right? So the idea is that the quantum fluctuation can destroy, at least in principle, destroy this Nael ground state. And now, there's all more reason to believe that this is the case, because in the 1930s, the only solution we know for the Heisenberg model is the 1D solution by Hans Bethe. In fact, that remains true until now. So it's amazing that Bethe, you know, solved this 1D chain a few years after the invention of quantum mechanics, right? It's just absolutely amazing. But Bethe's solution of the anti-ferromagnet has no order. So he built in, his solution has this physics built in. So in fact, the spins are not ordered, they only have power law decay. So I guess, there's reason to doubt it. And of course, you know, if you only have mean field theory, of course, nowadays we know that, you know, you can throw mud at anyone who only has mean field theory. It's not controlled. It's not defensible. So poor Nael had a hard time for many years, about for 5 or 6 years. And he was vindicated only in 1950 when my late colleague Cliff Shaw and his collaborator were able to do neutron scatter experiment and indeed found that such a state exists in nature. Well, of course, I think even before that, there are a lot more circumstantial evidence. You know, Nael was trying to explain the uniform since the fact that they came and so on and so forth. You know, there, he did a lot more than just. Okay. But still, he was being viciously attacked. And, So that finally, everybody became convinced. Of course, Landau is a very smart man, so none of this was written down. So I looked through his collected works, and there was no sign at all that he had any doubt about anti-ferromagnetism. The only thing I found was that Friedel wrote an obituary for Nael, and in that published in Physics Today, and in that he mentioned this controversy. He ended by saying that Nael never recovered from this, and all his life he always doubted the usefulness of quantum mechanics. Yes, he had his bad experience. So, anyway, so that's the kind of the early history of Magnus. I think the forgotten part of history. And from the 1950s, of course, we all educated, you know, believing that this is something obvious. In fact, so I think the understanding is that apart from one dimension, which is special, and the Nael state should be the ground state. So I think the next development really came Phil Anderson in 1970. So he revisited this question again that we believe was raised by Landau, kind of 25 years later. So I think he was asking the question, well, is there a way of beating Nael? Right? Nael was so successful. Can we find an example in 2D, in general dimension greater than one, where we can defeat Nael, where there's no order in the ground state, that this quantum fluctuation is dominant? And so his idea, I think the insight behind this is the notion of forming singlet. Quantum mechanically, of course, if you have two spins, right, then the ground state is a singlet, up, down, is up. It's not just up, down, right? That's quantum mechanics, okay? And so, in fact, if you revisit the Beta's one-dimensional example, you can imagine starting this way. Let's think about doing this, writing down some variation of wave function, just trial wave function, right? So if you're in the L, you would write down just up, down, right? Now, of course, we know this is not a ground state because it's mutual spin flip, but this is a trial wave function. So the energy per bond would be J over 4, right? Because it's spin a half on each side, so you can take that per bond is J over 4. Now, if you go quantum mechanically, and instead of just up, down, let's write down a trial wave function of singlets. Now this, of course, is not very good because it breaks the translation of symmetry. But let's not worry about that for a minute. So this is a problem you can, it appears in our general exam. You can easily calculate this. And so the energy is, of course, SS plus 1, right?
For a singlet.
One is quantum mechanics, so that means that S, small s, is the most quantum mechanical thing. This is dominated by 1. And so this is 3/4, right? But you gain only every other bond. So the energy gain is 3/8 J. So this is already better. Right. So in fact, this is reasonably close to the exact solution of Beta. Right. Okay. This is very far away. Okay. And now our present understanding is that the Beta solution is actually a superposition of these singlets, but with longer and longer range, right, with infinite distribution of length. Right. So Anderson said that, well, why don't we do something similar? And try to find a situation where this superposition of singlet is a better trial wave. Now, in order to defeat Nael, you need another ingredient, right? The ingredient you can see here is that, obviously, if you go to higher and higher dimension, this guy starts to lose. Because if you go to higher dimension, this guy, you know, has neighbors. So this is actually z times the constant number of neighbor. So the more neighbors you have, the better off you are. And this guy, It doesn't seem to depend on dimension.
Okay.
We could do this. So 1D is actually the perfect ideal situation. 3D, you probably guarantee to lose, right? So 2D is a battleground, right?
So first of all, so either two dimension.
And the other ingredient he says is that, well, you want to kind of suppress Nail as much as possible. And so the idea is to go to what is called frustrated lattice. And an example of this is a triangular lattice.
Okay.
And the idea is that on the triangular lattice, if you have a spin
that anti-parabolic line,
so these guys want to be
opposite,
then this guy is kind of stuck.
He doesn't know to point up, then this guy is unhappy. If he points down, this guy is unhappy.
So he cannot please everybody.
So around the 1960s, people coined the word frustration
to describe the situation.
Whenever you have this kind of a situation where the spins don't know what to do, we call this frustration.
So this is another
technical sense of this word in my title.
Okay, so the triangular lattice is an example of a frustrated lattice.
So Anderson says that, well, why don't we try this kind of a wave function on the lattice?
Now, of course, unlike 1D, you have more possibility because you can put bonds here, bonds here. We can cover this guy by this finger, and you have many, many possibilities. So quantum mechanically, of course, you can just add them to the position, right? And so you sum on all possible things. And so this is the quasi resonating gradient bond state. This is I guess the origin comes from Benzene, Pauling's idea of resonating these bonds. But, you know, this is over an infinite space. And now, of course, I've drawn a cartoon where you only have nearest neighbor thing. You can, of course, imagine long and long range singlets and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is a reasonable trial wave function. And I guess they did some work to show that this has pretty good energy. In the meantime, people quickly realized that for Heisenberg model, the triangular lattice is actually not that frustrating. Because the example I gave you was I was cheating. I was saying that the spins are pointing up and down. But in fact, on a triangular lattice, people quickly were able to show that there is a ground state, there is a nail ground state, where the spins just point 120 degrees to each other.
So everybody is slightly, can still, you know, nobody's
perfectly happy, but everybody compromised, right? So this is compromised thing.
So in fact, the triangular lattice for Heisenberg model is not that frustrating, and the one who's frustrated was Anderson.
So that's kind of, so he was frustrated, and I think this kind of was forgotten for a number of years. Nobody paid too much attention. I think even in 1970, nobody paid too much attention to this. But then the whole thing was revived in 1987 with the discovery of high-temperature superconductors. And high-temperature superconductors, the connection to this is that the high-temperature superconductors is indeed has origin with these, one of these mod insulators that I told you about, where we have strong correlation. The new thing is that we have the new ingredient called doping. So in other words, we can remove, by doping, it means that we can remove some of the electrons from the lattice. So we can remove. So these are, starts up being, these are the localized electrons that are bonding the single. So you can imagine being able to take out some of these sites. Okay. Now, the minute you take out some sites, then this becomes a mobile system. Right? Because before you take out the site, this has spin degrees of freedom. There's no charge degrees of freedom. Nothing can move. You can move virtually, but nothing can move really. But the minute you put in a finite density of these vacancies,
then these vacancies can move. So morally or generally, this has to be a metal at least. So this insulator immediately becomes a metal. But if you look at this picture, you might imagine that this, in fact, is a superconductor. Right? Why? Because a superconductor is a collection of what we call Cooper pairs. Cooper pair is nothing but that transforming a singlet. Okay. So I can look at it as kind of like whether the glass is half filled or half empty. From the point of view of the vacancy, if I have a few vacancies, then I just have a few vacancies and the background is just in liquid state. But from the point of view of these singlets, I can imagine that this is a collection of Cooper pairs. I have a linear superposition, coherent superposition of Cooper pairs, and that is a superconductor. So this gives you this marvelous idea that if you can dope into this thin liquid, we can get a superconductor. And this has to be a high temperature superconductor because the energy scale, electronic scales, right, of hundreds or thousands of Kelvin, and we don't need the photons, which is the source of having low energy scale for conventional superconductors. So this, of course, gave a lot of excitement. But of course, Anderson is also viciously attacked by various people. So the first complaint was that, well, this theory is based on this resonating valence bond, but the real system is a square lattice. No frustration or nothing, and we know that you start out with a Nail state. So Nail, of course, won there. Why do you think that this has anything to do with the state of your dope? And so that's the beginning of a great deal of argument. So on and so forth. So that goes on and on. But in the meantime, a number of people realized that, maybe it's time to go back and revisit this quantum spin liquid story. Because this dope problem is really too difficult for us. Okay. So let's instead of spending all our time arguing with each other, let's kind of retreat a little bit and go back to this spin liquid. So in the 90s, there was a lot of theoretical effort and going back to this idea of making an RBB safe. Right. So I guess the hope is that, well, if we can demonstrate that such a state actually exists, then maybe there's more, this kind of scenario may be more believable. Maybe not, but there was a lot of theoretical effort, and so this is why I draw this. So I think in the 90s, a lot of progress was made in terms of understanding this RBB state, if it exists. So the question is, can we classify them? Can we understand the nature? And what was missing all this time is relation to real experiments. We still don't have examples of these things. So this is all still a theoretical construct. But I think in this period, something very interesting happened. Because originally, even in Anderson's vision, this spin liquid state was defined as something by what it is not. Okay. So the original picture of a spin liquid is that it's something that does not order. No nail order. So it's kind of an anti-something, right? No nail order, down to zero temperature. And to be more technical, it really should apply to having an odd number of spin and a half per cycle. Because if you're an even number, then we know many examples. You can form a local singlet, and that's not so surprising. So originally, it was just an idea of, can we defeat Nail? Right? Can we? But it turns out that with all this work in the meantime, it turns out that this state, if you manage to defeat Nail, is much more interesting than simply that it doesn't order. Okay. And so this goes under the name of emergence. This is the other part of my So the idea is that you can have a situation where you start with a kind of garden variety Hamiltonian, like a spin Hamiltonian, very simple. But at the end of the day, the low energy physics, the excitations, are totally new objects that were not there in the original Hamiltonian. So you have totally new physics showing up. And so that's, again, you know, fraction quantum Hall effect is one of the first examples where fractionally charged objects showed up, even though you start, you only have integer charge in the beginning. Okay, so the understanding people had during this decade is that that this quantum spin liquidism is actually a prime example of this phenomenon of emergence. So when this new order disappear, it's predicted that new particles would show up. So they are emerging particles. And examples are something that would carry what we call spinon, as opposed to electron, which carries spin half. Okay. So the elementary excitations are neutral objects. They're like electrons, they have losses charge. They're neutral objects, but they carry spin half. Okay. So they're not there in the original formulation. We only have spin. We don't have electrons, but we don't have spinons. And in contrast, you know, in the Nail phase, the elementary excitations are ghost zone mode, which are just spin waves. And spin wave carries spin one, and they're boson. But these guys carry spin half, so we don't know of any magnet apart from one dimension where just spin half excitation lives. Now, because these guys are so weird, they are emergent. When they exist, they also cannot exist by themselves. So it turns out that they are always coupled to some cage field. And these cage fields are again emergent cage fields. They're like the electromagnetic field in our world, but they're different. And they can come in different varieties. Okay. And more generally, I think our understanding is that these systems are all described by some kind of compact gauge theory. So compact is not so surprising because we have a solid system of a lattice. So all these gauge fields are defined in a lattice and they're periodic under 2 pi. So they have to be compact. And they somehow all gauge theory of one kind or another. And turns out that the decombined phase of this gauge theory is the quantum spin. Whereas the Nail phase is the confined phase. Okay. So that's the kind of understanding that emerged over this decade. And so people have actually come up with a number of scenarios and examples. So let me list them. So we have some common examples. One is that you may have a two-dimensional spinon. Now these spinons, these elementary excitations, can actually have different statistics. They can be fermion, they can be boson, they can be anion. But one problem example is that these are spinons are fermion. Okay. And if they're fermion, then they can have a Fermi sleep. Okay. So these spinons actually have a Fermi surface. But of course, then they will be coupled to the new one, to compact new radiation. Well, if it's deconfined, then compactness doesn't matter, so you want to make sure. So this
this is one class of possibility that people were discussing. The second class is that, again, we have spin-off. But now these guys actually satisfy a Dirac spectrum. Okay, so instead of having a Fermi seed, these guys are kind of Dirac cone. Just like the electrons in our world, it's massless. Okay, so it's as if we are massless electrons. And again, here's a couple, of the U1.
Again, in two dimensions.
Okay, so this is actually very close to the world we live in, if we're in two dimensions. Except that in this world, the fine structure constant is about one, right? Because there's no small parameter, unlike QED. Right, so this is a world where the gauge field is strongly fluctuating, and so on. Okay, and of course, these spin-ons, in any gauge theory, the spin-ons are not physical because they don't have the spin-on Green's functions are gauge invariant, right? And it's a strongly coupled gauge field. But I would argue that these spin-ons are no less real compared with the electrons in our world. The electrons in our world are also not gauge invariant. You cannot write down electron Green's function, but we're accustomed to thinking about electrons as real, but that's totally wrong, right? That's not. And that's because in our world the fine structure constant is very small. So it's a good approximation to forget about the gauge field for a minute, right? And imagine the electrons are real. So I think the spin-ons are as real as, or as unreal as the electrons in the world, they exist. Okay. The third example, so these are the gapless examples. Third example is that these spin-ons can be gapped. And now we can have two possibilities. One is, if you're three dimension, now if your spin-ons are gapped, then you're left with these gauge fields, right? This U1 gauge field. In three dimension, it's possible to have a confined phase of this U1 gauge field, which is like our world. So this will have photons, just like our world, right? Except that the speed of light is given by the exchange energy, and not this slow. If you want to look for slow light, you can come here. Okay, so that's another possibility. And finally, the fourth possibility is in two dimension again. You can have gap spin-on. And naively, you would say that we know that in two dimension, a U1 compact U1 gauge theory is always confining, right? So you might say that this is not possible, and indeed it's true. But then that U1 gauge theory can then break down into Z2 gauge theory, right? Which then can have a deconfined phase. Okay. So in practice, the way it's done is that the spin-on pairs. That's one way of doing it. Now, if you start with the spin-on Fermi surface, we know that Fermi surfaces are generally not stable to pairing. And so if they pair, then you break the U1 down to Z2. Just like, so this is again as real as unreal as the real physical superconductor that we have. They are indeed described by Z2, our gauge theory. Okay, and so this is a very interesting corner, because these guys turns out to be described by topological field theory. And this is something that was emphasized by my colleague, Xiaogao Wei. Understood this, as usual, 10 years ahead of the rest of us. And so the thing that he emphasized was ground state degeneracy, which depends on the topology of the space, on the genus number. So this state is topological in the sense that the dejected. Now, you know, usually if you have a single ground state, it should be a unique ground state.
But in this situation, you have ground state degeneracy. Basically, it has to do with how many ways you can poke a half flux, a pi flux through different holes in your genus system. So this is an outline of what, you know, all these people were happily doing theory. Meanwhile,
there's also an important breakthrough in that we now have exactly soluble models, exactly soft models. Started by Gattaya.
He does not really start with a Heisenberg model, but he starts with something more complicated that he is able to solve. And the solution really exhibit, different solutions exhibit the physics of all these different gauge theories. So we have a lot of theoretical support. Okay. But still we are accused of being string theorists until this comes along. So I think I'm happy to tell you that today we have examples of these states. Some more firm than others. Some are more firmly established than others. I think none is absolutely nailed down. But I think depends on, you know, some of us are of course true believers. So you can trust me anyway. But I think, to be honest, I think some of them are very strong candidates. Some of them are more murky. And the strongest candidate in my mind is actually as an example of this class, which is very interesting. Right? The spinons appear, behave like electrons. And that was the discovery of Canova. And it turns out that there is a class, we found that there's an organic material. So organic material simply means that it's a molecule. Against these big molecules that form a crystal. You know, not that big. They may have 20 atoms, you know. But they stack to form some molecules, and they form layers. They form layered molecules. And it turns out that if you do the count, these are actually more insulated. So there's, on average, there's, for each molecule, is exactly one spin and a half. Right? So this is our hydrogen atom. It can come in the form of some organic molecule that happens to stack. And the stacking is that if you look from the top, they approximately, not exactly, but approximately forms a triangle atom. Okay. But now you say to me, well, you know, we thought that the triangle lattice was defeated, right? It's not frustrated enough. Well, turns out that this thing, there was another axis that escaped most of us. And that is going back to this U over T picture. As I allude to you, for large U, we have mod insulator. For small U, we have metal. Okay. The Heisenberg model that I derived for you was for a very large U. So this material turns out to live here, very close to this mod transition. So they are on the hairy edge. So they are insulated, morally, but you know, honestly, they are kind of weak insulator. They're on the hairy edge, right? But morally, they're insulated. So morally, the law into physics is described by some spin, Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian is very complicated. Not simply the size of the model. There are many, many terms, and we don't know. But maybe we don't care, right? So to declare moral victory, all we have to say is that we have a system with some spin, with some, that's described by spin degrees of freedom with some complicated Hamiltonian. And if that has a interesting ground state, doesn't order, then we have defeated now. Right? So this is a new ingredient beyond frustration that is needed, turns out, to defeat now. Okay. But to make a long story short, experimentally what is discovered is that what he measures, the first measurements are simple measurements like spin susceptibility and specific heat. And it turns out that the specific heat, the first thing that got us really excited is that specific heat pretty much is linear temperature. Okay? And you may remember that this is a property of Fermi C. If you have spin wave excitation, right, like phonon, then the specific key is TQ, because you count the degrees of freedom. So it's very rare to get a linear specific heap. And of course, all the methods we know have linear specific heap. But this thing is an insulator. So for an insulator to have a linear specific heap is very unusual. So they immediately suggest that maybe this scenario is being realized. Also, that's a completely the constant. And that again is a property of the Fermi system. It's Pauli's susceptibility. Okay. And more interestingly, several years later, people were able to measure thermal conductivity. And it was found that this thing goes to a constant at low temperature. So the idea is that we have a Fermi C. So this guy is a charged insulator, so we cannot measure the transport. It doesn't carry current, but it should carry entropy, because it's at 3.5 degrees of freedom. So a flow of this fluid would carry heat, just like an electron. An electron indeed carry heat because there's something called Wieland's Franz law, coupled with heat is proportional to the conductivity, charge infusion to charge conductivity, which for metal goes to a constant because of scattering by disorder at low temperature. And so this is again the signature that this Fermi surface lives. But this is significant because this means that whatever carriers giving rise to these thermodynamic quantities are actually mobile. They're not just sitting there. And furthermore, this coefficient turns out to be very large. Okay, so it's conducting heat like a very good metal. In fact, it's comparable to kind of a garden variety copper. No, that is not very, very pure, but garden variety. If you take a copper wire and cool it down to millikelvin, it turns out to be composite. Okay.
What's scattering these
atoms? Defects. It was scattered by defects, just like any, even though it doesn't carry charge, it's scattered by defects, any kind of defect.
Is there any way to effectively measure the Hamiltonian for this material?
No, that would be very difficult.
High temperature?
I think that would be very difficult.
We don't know what
Hamiltonian is. We don't know what Hamiltonian is. So it's a solution looking for a problem, yeah. Okay. So,
what about the gamma term that we have to use it if you can, in the traditional thing, we can relate that?
Yeah, so this term is the correct value because this gives you what's called effective mass or the bandwidth, which we expect to be the exchange constant. And this is about right. So, you know, we roughly know the, I shouldn't say we don't know anything about it, right? So we roughly know the scale because to go to high temperature, we can fit the usual Curie-Weiss law and get some effective scale. We can't go beyond that. So we know roughly the scale, and the scale is right. Okay. Another thing we know that is right is that there's a relation between these two numbers in free fermion. The ratio is called Wilson number. And it is very, maybe by accident, very close to free fermion. Okay, so it looks good. Okay. But of course, not everybody is totally convinced because there are in quantum physics, we live in a complicated world. Nothing is ever simple. So it turns out that there are phase transition. There are phase transition. There seems to be a phase transition at 6 Kelvin. And at the moment, nobody knows what the phase transition is. Some of us are guessing that maybe it's spin on pairing. I guess that's the natural phase transition to guess if you don't break any symmetry. So that's one of the open questions that we actively are discussing. These things. Okay, so I think that's our best example that we have. A second example turns out to be back to this frustration idea, and this is something called the cargo lattice. Okay. So this turns out to be the most frustrated of the two-dimensional lattice. So the cargo lattice is. Where you have corner sharing triangles. You can think of it as triangles that share corner, whatever they call. The kagome is a Japanese word which describes this pattern of basket weave you might see. Sometimes you have these chairs, the brewer chairs have some, right? Have this weave and it looks like this. Yeah.
there's one outside Leon's office. Huh? So there's one basket outside Leon's office.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so they are quite common. Yeah. I didn't bring my own basket. Yeah, actually, it turns out I was flying Japan Airlines, you know, on the tray.
Yep.
This thing showed up with a little candy in the middle. Yeah. I guess it's very open, so you save material. This is probably the cheapest way you can make a basket. Yeah. Anyway, this is a very frustrating lattice because unlike the triangle lattice you can think of as a face sharing, this is corner sharing. Okay, so this is very frustrated. And actually now, going back to this numeric, this actually good numerical evidence, people for a long time suspected that this, unlike the triangle, this may be enough to stabilize the semi-liquid phase, but people don't know for sure. And so people took a lot of effort to try to make these, you're thinking, would nature make a crystal like this? This is kind of odd, right? You have to make a crystal. Like this. It turns out that the first examples of these are gyrosites, and so they do exist. They are very rare. They were discovered in the last century in Spain. There's a region in Spain called Gyros, But some of you may remember that the first time they sent the rover to Mars, it was reported that they have evidence of water. You know what that evidence is? The evidence is that the first time they drill into rock, they find some rock and they drill into rock and analyze what it is. The first chemical they saw was a gyrosite with a carbon reaction. And the reason is that these things work on Earth, they can only grow when there's water. Right? There's some OH. So that was the evidence for water. So it turns out that these frustrated magnets are very commonplace on Mars. Frustration for us. No. I finally figured out that I've been living on the wrong planet. So, anyway. Now, I'll be curious what they find this new rover. They probably find more gyrosites, more cargamine, more frustrated magnets. But the one that they found on Mars is not very good because the spin is classical, the spin 5 hours. So it's too classical for our purpose. So it took a long time. So the first example, we need a spin 1/2. So the first example was made by chemists at MIT, Dan Nocera, and he's been working with a neutron scattering, Young Lee, to study it. So now he has grown large single crystals and so. So he'll be coming to our town meeting and discuss.
Is it known? Is it known whether spin 5 halves is that ordered?
Yeah, it's ordered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it finds a way to make some classical order. There's still interesting degeneracy, So that's anyway. So it turns out that again, experimentally, it seems to be gapless. Okay, but unfortunately. They're not quite pure, so they're contaminated by local disorders. So again, we have to live with some real world. So for a time, we thought that this may be an example of this direct spin liquid for a time, because it doesn't have a linear specific heat, something smaller. But more recently, this is where the numeric guys come in. So finally, the numerical guys seem to got this problem nailed using this DMRG method that they developed. It's very delicate. Turns out that the ground state is extremely delicate. There are many competing states, and it's very, very difficult to nail down what it is. And they think they've nailed it down. And so the best numerical evidence is that if you really have a spin 1/2 cargomate, it belongs to this class. It's a two-dimensional C2 spin nickel with a gap. So that is, of course, still very interesting. But now we have a problem because the experiment doesn't seem to see this gap phase. But then, of course, the experiment is not simply described by Heisenberg, but there are other firms. And so that's the sort of thing that keeps a solid state physicist busy and employed. So there's a lot of discussion going on, both from the point of view of numerics, how to connect with this and where to connect the experiment and so on and so forth. So I think all these things are happening and make it interesting. So finally, let me mention one more development which I find very exciting, and that is that there is now a connection of these to quantum information, in particular the idea of entanglement entropy. That's playing a very dominant role now in our discussion. So people realize that the entanglement entropy gives us a tool to analyze. If someone gives you a ground state, it gives us a tool to try to put these into this classification. What kind of ground state? Does it belong here? What kind of Z2 spin liquid it is? And I think the most exciting development here is, so it's back to this idea that if someone gives you a state, apart from the fact that it doesn't order, can you tell me what it is that's special about the state, right? What characterizes it, right? And so there was the notion of ground state degeneracy, but that turns out to be very hard to measure, even numerically. But it turns out that this entanglement entropy allows you to measure this, essentially this ground state degeneracy, and people have successfully done this, and a couple of examples that they know. So just to briefly say that entanglement entropy says that if I have a ground state for system, I divide it into half, I integrate up, use this as a bath, and I can calculate the entanglement entropy of this. And it was shown by Kitaev and Preskill, and then independently by Xiaogang Wen and his student Michael Levin, that the entanglement entropy has a term which is linear in the perimeter, but it turns out that there is a not universal term which gives you the information about the this ground state degeneracy. Right? So by measuring the entanglement entropy, you can actually tell that your state is a topological state. So I think that's a very deep and important development, because up to now, people can only say that it doesn't order, but it doesn't, what does it mean and what's special?
How do you measure it? How do you measure it?
Experimentally?
Yeah.
No, we can't measure it. This is for numerics. Yeah. So I guess this, that brings me to my last point. So I think this is still missing. Yeah, I think this one is, we're building these bridges. This is still missing. Oh, I think the day we're not, I think we're not far from the day when, somebody, the numeric people would say that, if you give me a Hamiltonian, I can show you what the ground state is, and then maybe the experimenters can go out and find a material. Right? But at the moment, I think this is still the weak link. And, this notion of entanglement entropy and ground state degeneracy, of course, something that belongs here. Right? Belongs to somebody's imagination. Okay, so I think that's summarized, what happens here and what gets us excited. Hopefully we'll make some progress.
So you painted it as a retreat away from doping back to spin liquid. So when is it time to charge ahead?
As you know, some of us never gave up, banging our head against the wall. But so I don't think we should give up. Any time is good, too. The mounting an attack. But I think this really gives us more confidence about what we're doing.
Can you explain why this organic material works? Why does it work so well?
You mean this experiment?
Yeah.
Well, I think this proximity to the Lamarck transition is the thing that was new with this organic that people didn't realize before. That another way of, I think, being near a metal, right? Maybe it's not so crazy, right? I mean, you want a Fermi surface. That's the way my friend Center likes to think about. If you want to be a Fermi surface, maybe you should start with a metal, which is Fermi surface, and then try to kill that Fermi surface. Right. And by driving it through a Mach transition, maybe this you can think of it as a remnant of the physical electron Fermi surface, the electron somehow lost its charge. Yeah. So that was a thing that was not appreciated before this experiment, because people were looking just for frustrated systems.
and being near transition is actually another route.
So just following up on that, another thing that I think being close to this transition gives you is longer range hopping, which introduces kind of longer range frustrating terms. Is there a way to, so for example, a square lattice with J1, J2
right.
may also be a spin length.
Right, yeah.
Is there a way to disentangle that from kind of this other source?
Yeah, that's long range hopping, but I think people believe that it's not so much the hopping rather than, you know, things called ring exchange. You can hop around a plaquette. Then you can get these ring exchange term. I think Matthew has been working, his colleagues have been working a lot on these. You can have this ring exchange term, which tends to stabilize this. I think they seem to be more powerful than this J1
and J2. And they're very good at getting rid of the compactness of the.
Try to get into this deconfined phase.
Yeah. You mentioned that you arrived to compact gauge theory, but at the end of the day, you mentioned only U1.
Yeah.
Are there other examples?
Yeah, actually, the natural starting point is an SU2 gauge theory.
But there are also
written down. But most examples that we're aware of seem to break that down very quickly to U1. But the full SU2, I don't know what that example.
Do you foresee building any bridges back to lattice gauge theories and high energy physics? Because it seems certainly some of the technology and language is borrowed from there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we benefit a lot of it. But I think the new thing about this thing is that the meta field. Right. So.
Right.
So unlike that's what makes this first two example interesting, because it's a meta field that comes in, and I think now our understanding is the meta field of course helps deconfine. Presumably because of you have the gapless excitation, they are dissipative and they help stabilize this deconfined picture. So they are able to kill this instanton argument of Polyakov and so on. So, and that's something that the particle physicists were not particularly interested in. They are interested in what we see.
But there is matter in the universe.
Yeah, I guess. I guess in quantum particles. Yeah, so maybe this has something to do with quantum particles.
But this is two-dimensional.
Two-dimensional, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So if you make a 2D quantum plasma, maybe it'll be interesting.
Oh, but some of these phases are in three-dimensional.
But those are very relatively more simple now. You know, they're just conventional.
Mm.
Photons. Yeah, but surely, you know, But I think this quantum Monte Carlo, this is the time problem, and that's something that, of course, it's the same thing that Fokker and plasma people. Maybe they can learn from the MRG, maybe the MRG can help them. If there's here we're able to solve a complicated interacting problem without sign problem. And they haven't, I don't think anyone has started thinking on that.
Question. Is the connection between the entanglement entropy in these, you know, interesting phases or properties of the ground state restricted to two dimensions, or has this been studied in higher dimensions?
That I don't know. Any expert can help me. I think they have been so far studied in two dimensions.
It's gender dimension.
Huh? You think it's general?
Yeah. It's known.
Yeah. So they are the next to leading term, right? Like in the higher dimension, this will be a surface. Right. But then there's a constant term. Information is contained.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.